So the reason we began with looking at Scriabin and Christianity of faith was first to get a model, Hegel's original model for spirit. And his original model for spirit, I suggested, was the notions of life and love. And it's these notions that are translated, or need to be translated, into the notion of spirit, in which, as I'll suggest, the notion of recognition replaces the notion of love, and the notion of historical society replaces the notion, or social practice replaces the notion of life. Now, in saying all of that, I wanted to suggest from the get-go, before we even open the book, that there's no God in Hegel, that there are no big things hovering about, that there's nothing mysterious, that all of that stuff. Chuck Taylor used to teach here and have the office next to me. But spirit does not posit itself. That's a Fichtean ego. I don't know what Taylor was thinking. So just forget all that stuff about, you know, God and spirits and all that. Nothing to do with the phenomenology. Phenomenology is a continuation, spirit of Christianity, which is a story about a kind of historical society. Secondly, continuing this thought, I want to suggest that the notion of idealism and the notion of an infinite in Hegel, remember his model of the infinite is two people in love. That's infinite because they don't find anything, they don't find the other person external to them. That the other is an internal. And as long as the other is internal, and he'll use the phrase the absolute other, as long as your absolute other is internally related to you, then you have no outside, and therefore, in the relevant sense, the totality can be infinite. It's going to be more complicated in the phenomenology, but the model of love is his first model of the infinite. So it's an immanent absolute. And that's the third thought. The third thought is that Hegel is some kind of modern Aristotelian who is reacting against, in his case, Kant, and the notion of law as a notion of outsideness. And his question was, how can I make the entire structure a matter of something in which concepts are always already instantiated and concrete in practice. And hence you'll get this notion in Hegel of the concrete universal. Puzzling concept, but nonetheless, be assured what it means is it's a universal that, unlike a Platonic form or unlike the moral law, is always already actual. So in a certain sense, and this is true metaphysically for every Aristotelian, against every Platonist, actuality precedes possibility. It's always a test case. How do you know you've got an Aristotelian or a Platonist? If actuality precedes possibility. Ergo, just to give an example, Heidegger and Being in Time, is a Platonist, right? Because he goes over and over about the primacy of possibility over actuality. Finally, I was interested in the notion of the causality of faith. That is some way in which our experience of how we are bound up together is the experience of having lost that togetherness. And that's where I want to start today. Shortly after writing Spirit of Christianity and this faith, Hegel read Adam Smith and Ferguson, great Scottish writers of political economy, and he realized that the notion of society or community that he was using in the Spirit of Christianity's faith referred to pre-modern Gemeinschaftlich enclosed communities. So his model of the causality of fate was dependent on this idea of everything being like a small town in the middle of Iowa, or what we call the ancient, polis. Same thing. Except probably Athens is more interesting than a small town in Iowa. So he had a model of small town life, small communal societies, and Smith convinced him modern societies were not like that. That people could be connected to one another in all sorts of complicated and mediated ways, and that their relations of independence and dependence could be things that happened around their, behind their back, unknown to themselves. And that furthermore, the model of individualism that was already Kant's moral philosophy was actually something that belonged to society and not just to a certain type of moral philosophy. In short, the metaphysics of the Spirit of Christianity was simply outdated. And when he began to think about that, he suddenly began to think that there was at least something about Abraham that maybe he had not understood. Something about he says, even in the Spirit of Christianity and its faith, he says, only in diremptying myself from the other does the other become object. That is, when you are, to use the example he's using, they're madly in love. You do not experience the other as other. That's its charm. In fact, you find their otherness unimaginable. And hence, you only become aware of them as other later. Now, the most beautiful account of this that I know of is, in fact, in Emerson's Experience, which is a text about the death of his son. And what Emerson cannot get over is that his son has died and he's alive. And he says to himself, or imagines himself saying to himself, if were love were what I thought it was, which is what every lover, every parent thinks love is, then I could not have survived that death. That is because we were one. But I have survived. And that's the terror. I'm absolutely separate. So Hegel begins to think that this notion of distance of severance, of diremption, is not antagonistic to becoming self-conscious, but in fact necessary, that you can only really be self-conscious if you have a certain distance from the other. And he begins to think that diremption or severance is constitutive of the self, and that it is only by acknowledging the necessity and inevitability of severance, or I'll sometimes use the word transgression, can we avoid bad metaphysics, that is, the presumption of pantheism or closure. Diremption first appears in Hegel as criminality, as one person killing the other. But we might think, in the way that Abraham left his society, that Abraham, near his dam, kills Isaac, that history begins when one person kills another. That history begins with murder. It begins when the natural bonds of life and love are negated. History begins because life and love, as the spirit of Christianity gives us, are these natural bonds, and therefore not historical, not ways in which people inhabit their lives historically. So in the phenomenology, history is going to begin with Antigone, with law-breaking. So history begins with transgression, and I'll be arguing for the next year that his entire philosophy is a philosophy of transgression. It's about that word, the negative. Right? So only where there is law-breaking does history begin. That is, when the other stops being merely my internal correlate and becomes an object. So the question of how do we leave paradise? We leave paradise by breaking the bonds that we didn't know existed and we didn't know were there. We only ever have paradise after the fact. History begins by the loss of the object of love. So history is grounded in loss. And the phenomenology is going to be about loss. It has to be about loss, otherwise the final chapter can't be about memory. I just take it as obvious. If the last chapter is a memory, then the rest of the book has to be about loss. And then you have to recover that loss. So let's say it's a book about loss and mourning. Okay, what I'm going to do today is I'm going to chatter for about half an hour in anticipation of the introduction, and then we'll do the boring detailed commentary, which we may not finish, but whether I finish the introduction or not, please read Sense Certainty for next time, since we'll certainly want to begin it. Well, I'm beginning with the introduction, as I suggested, because Hegel did. He wrote the preface after completing the work, and it's a text that, as I said, really assumes both complete knowledge of the text and detailed knowledge of what was, for him, contemporary German philosophy, that is, Victor Schelling, Reinhold, Schulze, Jacobi, etc. But it's also a text, and I'll be saying a lot about this, the preface, it's such a long preface. And then it's a tiny introduction. Why a long preface and a tiny introduction? Because the topic of both is the impossibility of writing a preface or an introduction. That the preface is the continual anxiety about how he cannot begin. The introduction begins with this firm knowledge that there can be no beginning. You can't, the first sentence is really saying you can't have knowledge before you have knowledge. So you can't begin. That's what the introduction's about. The impossibility of beginning. Hence, I'm beginning by not beginning. I'm beginning by deferring. Well, one of the great Hegel myths a myth that I find even in Pippard and Pippin and Pinkard and Zeep and stir nearly everyone. One of the great Hegel myths of which the introduction is the locus is that Hegel somehow engineers a presuppositionless starting point. And this is supposed to be the great thing about the phenomenology, that it has a presuppositionless starting point. A neutral, non-question-begging, absolutely unimpeachable beginning from which, again, we can build the entire edifice. And the idea of a presuppositionless starting point is the sort of idea of which philosophers are extremely fond. There are all sorts of reasons for thinking that it's also a very bad idea. And that Hegel thought it was a bad idea. From the time of the difference shrift, that is, the difference between Fichtean and Schellingian philosophies, and these are external claims, and I'll come to the internal ones when we do the introduction. Hegel argued that all philosophy was historical and was conditioned and was socially mediated. And his way of thinking that all philosophy was historical was dull. First, he says, in a famous passage, that all philosophy is an expression of the need for philosophy. But the need for philosophy always emerges from the direction in a culture. That is, unless a culture was having deep problems, why would anyone bother philosophizing? There are just better things to do with one's life. And secondly, that an engagement with any philosophical moment is always an engagement with the history of philosophy itself. So that every philosophy is a crossroads between two historical forces. One, the cultural dimensions of its own time, which it's going to try, and in the different shrift he said, this is the unconditioned bit of philosophy. This is the bit a philosopher can't do much with and has to work against. This is the kind of dead matter. The way in which a culture is failing, the history of philosophy
is the other vector in which those thoughts meet.
So philosophy is always doubly conditioned. Secondly, Hegel denied and denies in the phenomenology that there could be a neutral method, that is, a method that was not also a content. From these two thoughts, it follows that there cannot be a presuppositionless starting point. If so, if there cannot be, then his claim is not the way in which he sets up the introduction will be a way of thinking about his present. And the presuppositions he will make in the introduction, and I'll suggest what they are presuppositions that were true for people living at a particular time and place, which is to say, it is right. That's one of the basic questions about the introduction is, who is the we? Who is we? So when I say that philosophy is always historical and cultural, I'm saying that philosophy always emerges from a crisis, which is why you can always tell bad academic philosophy, because it doesn't emerge from a crisis, it emerges from a puzzle. So Plato was responding to the crisis of confronting the collapse of the authority of Homeric text. That is, I mean, I take it the reason why Republic begins with Kadabah, I go down, he goes down, where? To the Piraeus. Why the Piraeus? Because that's the port. What happens in the port? It's where all the people from all the different countries with all their different gods come in. So what Plato was worried about was the death of the Homeric gods, that they had lost their authority because everyone had their gods. So he was living in a time of nihilism or polytheism, and he was trying, and the effort of the Platonic text is to resurrect some form of authority for the Greek people. Hegel too, and you can say obvious, this is what the discourse on method is about. Descartes is looking at the crisis, and the crisis is that there was no way of, there was no space for science, so that natural science was emerging in a conflict with religion. Prosecution of Galileo. That was his world, and therefore there was a crisis about the authority of knowledge. Well, Hegel, too, is responding to a crisis of diremption. And those diremptions, and again, the best recording of those diremptions, but they were true for everyone in his society, but the best place to find them is in Schiller. Schiller is a great Geiger counter. Letters on the Aesthetic Education.
is really the Ur-text for thinking through the problems. What are the problems? First, that reason, rationality, seems to lead to skepticism. Jacobi's claim against Kant, without the thing in itself, I can't enter into Kant's system. With the thing in itself, I can't stay in it. The thought that Kant's system was a transcendental skepticism was simply taken for granted that it didn't solve. Indeed, there are many, many more happy Kantians now than there were in Kant's time. I can't find, when I read around in that period, any, maybe Schulze, maybe one happy Kantian. Everyone else thought, this is brilliant, no one's done better, and it's a disaster. The Kant status from the get-go was both as a pinnacle and a problem. And it's interesting about his philosophical culture that it should have that two-sided character. It's one that our philosophical culture cannot seem to tolerate. It seems we want our pinnacles very small and acceptable. Secondly, so the problem is reason leads to skepticism. But this is right there in Pascal. You don't have to wait to Kant, right? Second, that the Newtonian physics creates a magnificent account of the natural world, but also utterly disenchants nature and turns it into a dead thing. So that nature becomes not a living totality, but a corpse. The Enlightenment and social reform leads to bloody revolution and the terror. And there's reasons for arguing, Rebecca Comey will be doing in a forthcoming book, that the chapter on the French Revolution and the terror is in a sense the core chapter of the entire phenomenology. We'll have to see if that's true when we get there. But clearly, the French Revolution was the major event, political event at the time, and the French Revolution, again, had this dual character, right? It was the great inauguration of liberty, equality, fraternity, you know, Fichte to the ends of his life stands up and toasts the revolution, and yet everyone knew that the terror was not an accidental feature of it. That the problem of the terror, in a way, and we'll get to this when we get there, there's a whole way of all these philosophers, including Hegel, trying to think that German philosophy should be the continuation of French politics. That German philosophy takes itself, both in the Romantics and in Hegel, as the peaceful, right, continuation of the revolution. Still, two-sidedness. And finally, the great humanism, the rejection of religion, the new materialism, leads to hedonism and crude immorality, all Rousseau's whining and complaining about the court. But the complaints were real. They're part of what brought on the French Revolution. The French Revolution is also about the new hedonism and the new materialism. And finally, the one that probably was at the center of Hegel, and certainly Schiller's thought, was the new individualism, which, again, the upside is inwardness, independence, individual autonomy. The negative side is atomism, fragmentation, alienation from society. So every single significant feature of modern social life itself has an utterly negative face. That's diremption. That is, society cannot get a hold of itself, not because it has unrealized ideals or is partial, but because its very ideals all seem to have a horrendous negative side. That's what the phenomenology is fundamentally about. That fact. Those diremptions. The problems with modernity are problems with our categories. That's what I didn't just say. It's with what we mean by individual and society, with reason, with nature, etc., etc., with reform, with revolution, with liberty, with equality. Each of these are categories. So we want to say that everyday life is constituted by a series of categorical commitments. And these basic presuppositions give shape to our world. For Hegel, our categories are clearly in a state of massive disorder. And the structure of that massive disorder, we've already seen the effects of it, that's what I just gave you, the structure of that massive disorder is a series of radical categorical dualisms. So dualism, as Hegel understands it, and I'll say a word about dualism in a second, is the way in which our lives have become partial and fragmented, and hence the reason why we experience forms of life that are internally self-defeating. So, we have the utter isolation of man or nature from God. Deism is simply the way of pushing God further out of the world. Secondly, the duality between man and nature, which goes along with the idea of the mechanization of nature. Individual community. In part four of the Discourse on Method, Descartes generates a provisional moral code. The development of the provisional moral code. Well, in order to understand what's going on with that, you have to kind of flip it around. Because what Descartes means is
morality is provision. That is, his moral code is, make no commitments which bind you in ways that you cannot withdraw from for reasons of self-interest. And he thought that that was rational, because to bind yourself in ways that counted your own self-interest would literally be a form of self-harm. So Descartes only understood morality as a form of what it's become. What is morality now? Descartes thinks nothing more than action coordination. It's the way alienated and isolated individuals coordinate their actions for the purpose of self-interest. That political philosophers, as disenchanted as Hobbes, and as enchanted as Rawls and Habermas, all think that morality is about action coordination. They all define that as the job. Find a fair form of action coordination for, right? Shows you that for them, they don't even realize that morality's already disappeared. Their notion of justice is about the absence of justice. Justice without justice. So the very notion of Cartesian self-possession is a way of cutting the self off from the rest of the world. Descartes utterly separates the notion of fact and value, and he does so by saying, by attaching fact to the notion of representation and value to the notion of desire, and his claim in the Discourse and in the Meditations is that, and this again is almost a dogma for us moderns, whatever is true or false is neither good nor bad. And whatever is good or bad is neither true nor false. That is, the notion of truth concerns merely what there is, independently of desire, independent of want, while what I desire, as Hobbes would say, what I find good, is up to me. It's whatever I find good. And Descartes seems to say, although he has this little problem with wormwood, but roughly, whatever I find desirable is desirable because I desire it. Hence, the world of facts and the world of values separate. Hence, the notions of good and evil fall outside cognition and fall outside reason. Hence, the notion of the liberal state is based on a form of skepticism. That's what we mean by the right over the good. We don't know what the good is, but we can agree that everyone can, you know, chase their own good as long as they leave everyone else alone. So we're basing a form of life and a form of society on skepticism. You want to ground the world in skepticism? And this is supposed to be the liberal achievement? Worse, reason itself gets cut off from eros, so that reason is taken to be, again, neutral, fact-finding, and the like, no part of an erotic pursuit.
and the mind hence loses its relationship to the body.
The phenomenology of spirit is about overcoming dualisms. And it assumes that we must overcome these dualisms, find ways in which these forms of one-sidedness are false in themselves and can be hooked up with one another. So the phenomenology is meant to show the origins and the nature of categorical one-sidedness. And to show, at least in outline, the possibility of overcoming that kind of one-sidedness. So the phenomenology is a text that's going to locate itself both within the major cultural dilemmas of its time and the major philosophical debates of its time, and it's going to suggest that those two things are internally connected. And they're internally connected because, again, ordinary life is always already philosophical to the extent that everyday life is always already constituted by its sets of categorical commitments. And I've tried to just say a little bit and enough in these kind of remarks to give you a hint about how that might be the case. That the big problems of metaphysics, so-called big problems of philosophy, the nature of categories, and the intimate problematics of living a life are connected. There are give you a sense of what the book is about, and therefore to give you a kind of anticipation of what to expect. And this does mean that my reading is somewhat different than the other interpretations of phenomenology you will be reading. So let me say a word or two just about kind of competing overall interpretations of phenomenology and why I'm a little skeptical of them, and then we'll have a break and then we'll come back and talk about the introduction directly. Well, you've already got the thought just looking at the text, reading the introduction, that phenomenology is going to be a progression of these forms of consciousness, and that these forms of consciousness, whatever they are going to be discovered to be internally contradictory, and that enacting those contradictions that are internal to each form of consciousness is going to require us to somehow move on. Give or take. That's how the book unfolds. So the questions of the book tend to be, first, about those transitions, how do they happen, what do they mean, and what are they for the sake of? Well, we know that Hegel's original project, which went along, which was the science of the experience of consciousness, was to write a kind of 150-page text and then use that as an introduction to his logic. So he meant the text as an introduction to his logic.
And at least there are some readings. Nikolai Hartman, but there are lots of others, that think that the phenomenology and the transitions in it depend on Hegel's logic for their cogency and intelligibility, and therefore deny that the phenomenology stands on its own. In itself, I find that reading unintelligible. For I am unclear how we're to get to the end of the book and get to the logic in order to find the truth about the transition. So, in other words, what that account doesn't do is explain how we actually read the book in the first place to get to the logic so we can come back and ground the transitions in the logic. So, in itself, this just seems to me wrong. But it's a very traditional view in a lot of ways. That is, the logic is the center of Hegel's system. The phenomenology is an introduction to the system. And for better or worse, I think that, and Hegel himself afterwards, seems perhaps to think that. But in truth, he actually never knew what to do with the phenomenology himself. He never knew how to place it with respect to his system. And I think we should take it simply as a free-standing text. There are ways in which we'll come to when we reach the end of the book, that it might, for those inclined, give you a way of getting to the logic, but then again, it might not. The contemporary view, which is the view of that Robert Pippin has made most noteworthy, and I take it, if everything I've read up till now makes sense, Robert Brandom's big book on the phenomenology when it comes out will be another version of the same, is that the real task of this book is to overcome epistemological realism, where the thought of epistemological realism, as it's here being interpreted, is the view that truth is fully mind-independent. That is, truth is simply a correspondence between propositions and states of affairs, and it's always possible that, given everything we know, a claim that we believe to be true can be false, and a claim that we believe to be false can be true. So, of course, the job of epistemology is to try to close that gap between what we know, all the evidence and our reasons, and the like. But realism is the belief that that gap cannot be completely closed without becoming idealism, where idealism is the view that there's an internal relationship between what we think there is and what counts as true. So, on the Pippin reading. So, and I take it we know appearances are not things themselves, is the beautiful ambivalence between idealism and realism. That is, it affirms idealism, we know appearances only, not things themselves, but somehow leaves realism dangling out there as a kind of, you know, of course, God's eye point of view. Well, according to this reading, the whole movement of the text itself is a kind of massive transcendental deduction in which each form of consciousness reveals the presuppositions of the previous forms of consciousness, so that each form of consciousness goes into providing the necessary conditions for the possibility of ordinary consciousness. And hence you have a regress into the ground. And when the book ends, you have the complete set of conditions for the possibility of ordinary knowledge, and nothing left out, hence the defeat of skepticism. So, the thought is, sense certainty, first form of knowledge, presupposes perception. So the necessary conditions for operating with sense certainty are found in the chapter on perception, and therefore we get further conditions for the possibility of knowledge. I'll be suggesting that phenomenology, I mean, first, given what I've just said, I don't want to say that the critique of skepticism and the critique of realism are not a part of the story. They clearly are. But I began where I did with the story about diremption and flagging those moments that all occur in spirit that concern hedonism, that concern the absolute state, that concern the French Revolution, the chapters on religion, which, of course, concern all the different conceptions of God and nature. That's not the only thing this book is concerned with. The view that this book is fundamentally epistemological can only be sustained if you read only the first 75 pages. After that, it becomes increasingly implausible. And although there are ways of saying that what goes on in the later chapters, that is, what kind of community of knowers are we, and how can we have a consensus about who we are and affirm who we are, to say all of that is just for the sake of saying that I'm entitled to say the book is on the table. That can't be why he's talking about the French Revolution. It just cannot be. So that this reading, the Chicago-Pittsburgh reading, is just overly epistemological and doesn't take seriously, I think, these questions of diremption that are all over the book and were all over the German philosophy in the time he was writing. Another view. Stern, in his, picks up a line that John Finley had years ago, that the fundamental task of the text is therapeutic. That at the end of the book we come to feel at home in the world by learning to let go of our categorical prejudices and one-sidedness. Very heavy work of therapy. Of course, and I want to get clear about this, I think part of the work is therapeutic. But what I take by that is that Hegel does need to convince each and every modern standpoint of its own one-sidedness
by revealing that one-sidedness in a context of series of temptations. And it's perfectly true that the depth of this account is going to depend upon, and I want to underline this, that Hegel must demonstrate not why positions are false, that's easy. He must demonstrate why they're tempting at all. That is, he must expose the structure of fantasy or hope or desire or ideality or despair that leads someone to come to a certain type of belief, and further to sustain it against the evidence. Because all philosophy is a sustaining of the implausible against the plausible. Now, what else could anyone think of who believed in monads? So we do need diagnosis and therapy. But this therapy is going to be complex because it has to recognize the depth of the pathologies. And furthermore, it must see how these pathologies were formed, where they came from. It must go back to some original scene, and original scenes are uncomfortable. But even something more. It must give us insight into loss and separation. That over and over again, Hegel is going to find that the motivating fantasy, and it's going to be right there in center, the motivating fantasy of philosophy is that it should overcome all loss and all separation, all disassociation, all disconnection. Coming to acknowledge the insuperability of loss and separation, coming to acknowledge the inevitability, the necessity of transgression, negativity, and death, are going to be essential moments in the overcoming of these dualisms. So, the goal is indeed a kind of therapy and a kind of healing, but it's a very, and this is, I guess we can here, but it's a very complex therapy because it is going to be both cognitive and affective. Indeed, more than any other philosophical text apart from Plato I can think of, it demands and will demand a type of affective investment. And indeed, you might have noticed that passage in the introduction where he tells you he's going to bring you to despair. Odd promise for a philosopher to make. Join me in a text so I can bring you to despair. But of course, that is just where I try to start the hour, namely by saying that only in that moment of loss, loss of self-assurance, loss of original narcissism, loss of vanity, loss of our idea of autonomy and independence, can we even begin? So despair Which, of course, I mean, this is not new. The Hegel philosophy always begins in despair. It begins in the cave in Plato. It begins in the method of doubt in the first meditation. But he wants a despair now that's not going to be despair as a scene of originality. That's what both Plato and Descartes wanted. They wanted, right, a pristine beginning. Hegel wants us to despair not at the beginning, but in the middle, from where we are. So, my first claim is going to be, when we start the introduction, that the introduction lodges us already in the middle, and that we begin in the middle. Where else do we begin? I mean, we begin from where we are. How can we begin at the beginning if we've never been there? And if we've never been there, how could anyone begin at the beginning? And what made anyone think they could ever begin at the beginning? Oh yeah, once upon a time. But that's a fairy story. This is life. Okay, let's have a break. And then we'll do some nasty textual things. Or nasty things in the text.